Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Chris Love. Chris is a progressive web app and search engine optimization expert. He's a 12-time Microsoft MVP who started writing HTML in 1992. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, before we get started into sort of the meat of the program, could we maybe just get a little bit of introduction to who you are? Possibly maybe tell us about kind of how you got started in this industry.
Okay, we can go all the way back to my childhood, back to the literally the early 80s. One of my teachers brought in a TRS 80, Trash 80, whatever computer, and I got fascinated with programming. And the library down the street got one too, and they were trying to get us to not play arcade games. And so they charged us 25 cents for like 15 or 30 minutes to sit there and program the computer in the library. And so I went down there and spent a lot of quarters programming that computer. So, but really when I formally got started was in college in the early 90s. Cut my teeth a lot on Borland OWL C++ back in the day, if somebody even remembers that these days. But I got fortunate. I got my junior year, or the third or fourth year of school, whatever. I got to join a project doing software energy models for textile processing. And that's when I really got to actually get paid to write code. And I turned that into my master's thesis and then parlayed that all, obviously, into a career. I started off doing like plant floor automation stuff, PLCs. I did a few years at Schneider Automation and factory automation kind of systems, SCADA, MMIs, those kind of things back in the day. Really where IoT is today. But at the same time, what was going on, obviously, in the early 90s, the web had just been introduced. And one of the things that I discovered was making web pages. And I actually got in trouble with my graduate advisor because I actually published kind of some of my research paper, because I was publishing papers in academic journals. And I think one of them, for some reason, wasn't getting published or something like that. I can't remember what the deal was. So I put it out on my own personal drive, so to speak, at NC State, and I showed my professor. I'm like, hey, I went ahead and just published it online, and he just looked at me and goes, "I don't know if we can do that. That may just violate the school's copyright laws." So, anyway, so I kind of went on this little mission to see if I could bring the web into the manufacturing area, because that's where I was kind of focusing all the time. And one thing led to another. Eventually, just after I left Schneider, I started my own independent consulting thing and started just doing all kinds of projects and building applications for people in all kinds of spaces. And yeah, I've had, you know, like certain niches I've kind of scaled up in and scaled back down when the industry went away, and done sit in the cube and the enterprise thing for a long time kind of stuff. So I've done quite a bit of stuff. I stopped counting projects, honestly, but it's got to be well over 1,000 different application projects over the years. And so that's kind of the trend. But I mean, you get to, you know, like 10, 12 years ago, like I call it the jQuery era. That's when I really realized I was kind of putting together what clients were actually talking about and concerned with, whereas where was I spending time? And I guess at the time I kind of realized they didn't care a whip about what I was doing on the back end. That didn't matter to them. It really mattered what was on the front end. Does it load fast? Is it usable? Does it make sense to me without thinking? All these kind of things. And so that's why I really, at that time frame, I really kind of pivoted to focus more on being known for doing front end stuff. I still do back end stuff, but that's not something I like really spend a lot of time promoting on. I'm not sure if it's, to me, it's not as unique enough, I guess, for a selling point to stakeholders, because they really don't care. But, you know, these days I build everything serverless in AWS and build on top of that. And from a subject matter expert area thing, I really focus on the progressive web apps. The last few years I've really gotten a lot into search engine optimization as well, because it fits really well with my whole shtick about being fast loading pages and good user experience. They really dovetail nicely, and so they resonate really well with like business types and stakeholders as well. So that's kind of how that journey, I guess, has evolved over about 25 years or so.
Okay, so how are you? What is your sort of average day like these days? What are you doing?
Yeah, I actually get up between 5 and 6 o'clock. I usually try to use that hour, half hour, to try to learn something, to kind of get my brain going and without like overloading myself. So I usually watch a few YouTube videos in the morning. It may be about technical stuff, but sometimes it's about more, other things that I'm interested in life or just something silly, but something just kind of get going. I take the dog on a walk and come back and dive in deep into, usually try to get as much coding done as I can, maybe by 10 o'clock, because usually at 10 o'clock I start having to dialogue with customers and phone calls and things like that for a few hours off and on during the rest of the day. So there's a lot of interruptions. And
are you still sort of a consultant running your own consulting thing, or what are you currently doing?
Well, currently I've got, I think, 5 or 6 open projects that I'm kind of essentially trying to juggle time. That's why I'm saying usually between 7:30 and 10 o'clock, I'm just like, do not disturb, write code. And then the rest of the day, it's, usually 1 or 2 phone calls or big long emails with clients and things like that, just to go over status things. But generally I can get 8 to 9 hours of actual coding in before I morph into my normal fat guy persona and go to karate or go do obstacle course stuff. So. And then, wrap up the day, essentially kind of winding down or, doing more reading and maybe watching some videos and stuff before I go to bed. So yeah, that's kind of my general schedule of things.
Very cool. Very cool.
And these days you're mostly seen as a progressive web app expert. Do you want to maybe go into progressive web apps, what they are, what they're useful for?
I'd love to unpack on that. So if I go back really to that jQuery era that I was talking about, one of the things I noticed back then was I could start essentially rendering stuff on the client, and that essentially morphed into what we call a single page application. And I kind of realized at the same time, because mobile was really hot and that native app thing had really caught on at the time, that it, to me, was kind of a challenge to see, can I make websites perform, behave much like the native applications? And a lot of the things people were saying about the web, I knew weren't really necessarily true. It really comes down to how do you actually build the application and make it work. So, and a progressive web app is there's 3 key pieces of technology you have to have in place. You need to be using HTTPS, but that's a given these days. If you're not using HTTPS, you need to probably stop what you're doing and go get a certificate. I can get them set up in AWS in like 5 to 10 seconds. So I think you got enough time to get the certificate set up. And they're free today. Back in the day, they were like $100, $200 a year. And they were actually a hassle of paperwork to actually go get. But, today we've got different ways to get validation done. But the core thing is having that encryption layer around the actual request so that you can't get that man-in-the-middle attack is the main thing you're trying to guard against. So that's a given. The other side of that HTTP puzzle, a lot of the more modern web APIs are gated behind HTTPS. Anything that's effectively considered might have access to personal data is going to be gated behind HTTPS. And some of them that are, you may not even necessarily think are personal data related might still be gated behind HTTPS. So like you can't register a service worker unless you're HTTPS. That's a given. The geolocation stuff it's been around for about 10 years to do the location, but the browsers are gradually kind of pivoting to make that one that's gated behind it, but they're trying to do it at a slower pace because they might break the web. There's still about 10 or 15% of the sites on the web that aren't secure right now. So anytime you see something like that, and it's not like just instantly rolled out, it's usually because the browser teams are trying not to, they literally say, we don't want to break the web. We have to be very cautious with this. And they have good telemetry on what features are actually being used, how they're being used, if they're being used incorrectly, all that kind of good stuff. You look at a lot of the modern features like USB access, Bluetooth access, file storage, camera access, and like we're using right now, those kind of things, they're gated behind HTTPS. The next one is actually another kind of easy one to do is the web manifest file. And really what this is, it's just a simple JSON file. And it's got some fields in there that provide some metadata to the browser and the operating system to effectively describe your site or your application. And it's simple things like the name of your application. You get like two theme color properties in there. What's your start URL? Which gives you the ability to track if someone's launched it from the home screen or not. And there's a few other things, like if you're in a right-to-left language versus left-to-right, you can specify that. You can specify, do you launch essentially looking like a native application, or do you launch with the browser Chrome or some variation between the two? Are you going to lock it into being portrait mode or landscape mode, or allow it to rotate? Those kind of things are also available to you there as well. The other big piece that's important there is you also have a field there for the icons, and these icons are what the platform is going to use to put that icon either on the home screen or the start menu or whatever it's going to do to actually install it. And there's a lot of debate over the language around add to home screen versus install, and you can waste a lot of time there debating that. I kind of tend to be more in the I like the concept of install because it resonates with customers more. The add to home screen, I think it confuses people a lot of times because they're like, that means I can't do it on the desktop, right? And I'm like, no, it doesn't. So now the thing is about these icons, I've got a tool online called PWA Starter. And it's like a little wizard that you walk through. It'll create a basic manifest file for you, but it also allows you to upload your logo or your icon that you want, the base one, and it'll create like 110 plus versions of that with different sizes and automatically put all the JSON in that file for you, and also create metadata that you need to put in the header for iOS and things like that. So it saves you from having to manually go do that, make typos, and because like 110 images is not something that's going to go really fast by hand. So you need to have that. And then the final piece is you need to have a service worker. And we'll unpack on this a lot because this is the key piece here. But you have to register a service worker from your regular web page, from the web, what I call the UI code, because I try to separate the two. And the service worker is just a JavaScript file, but it's a script that runs in a background thread. So it doesn't run on the same thread that the actual web page is running on. And that's a very key, important factor right there. So this allows you to do things on that background thread that won't lock up the UI thread. So today, a lot of the frameworks that we have lock up the UI thread because they're very process intensive. And there's really only one thread per tab. And so what happens is the browsers get stuck processing all that JavaScript, and then the page just basically freezes, and the people, the user can't do anything, they can't scroll the page, those kind of things. So you really see the effect a lot of times when you go to news sites and they've lobbed in hundreds of third-party scripts coming in. But even the frameworks, the average time to reach that time to first interaction on the web pages is usually between 20 and 30 seconds. And so that's pretty much unacceptable by most users. Like Facebook, it gets away with it because people are so enamored with the potential of getting content from people that they'll sit there and wait for it, basically. If you can get by with that, then I guess more power to you. I generally can't reach that level. So with the content, I call it content gravity because it just pulls people in no matter what the friction is to get to it. But the service workers are like this magical piece of application. From a developer point of view, if you know anything about serverless development, like I've spent a lot of time doing AWS Lambdas, but if you're a Microsoft, if you're in Azure, it's Azure Functions. To me, it operates a very similar kind of concept. It's there as long as it's needed, and if it's not needed, it essentially just closes or shuts down, and it just fires right back up when it's needed again. And there's, some people will complain, well, there's a little bit of latency. It's like 5 or 6 milliseconds. I think I can get by with that.
Same people that are acceptable for the 30-second framework load, and they'll be like, but it's 35 milliseconds.
You're absolutely right. I see a lot of the same people making that argument, and I'm like, oh, geez. The cool thing about the service worker, it intercepts all the network requests. And that gives you the ability to write the logic to determine how are you going to handle this request. Do I pass this along to the network and get the response from the server? Do I look in the cache and see if I've got a response that's still valid and return that one first? Do I try both of them and see who comes back faster? Or do I get the stale one and then get the network and replace it? Or do I just build one on the fly out of thin air? I can do that as well. And it doesn't have to be HTML. I can do CSS, JavaScript. If I really feel emboldened, I could base 64 encode an image string and pass that back up or whatever it may be. So you get the ability to really control it. When I was first introduced to service workers, I was at a conference in Santa Clara, and Patrick Meehan, at the time he was working on the Chrome team. He's the guy who created Web Page Test, which is like my favorite testing tool. But he did a presentation on service workers right before I did a presentation on single page apps. And so he was explaining the concepts to it. But the term he came up with, I still like to use today, he called it a proxy server in your pocket. Because you can turn it into a full-blown web server inside the web page. And I hate to say inside the web page because it's actually outside the web page. And you can have multiple tabs open and one single service worker servicing all of those open tabs. Mm. And it doesn't necessarily even have to be a web page or a web tab that's open. They also allow native push notifications. So the operating system can essentially wake it up, even if you're not on the phone or using the browser at all. It could literally just be in your pocket, and you're driving down the road and you can get buzzed by a push notification. Unfortunately, Facebook's kind of destroyed push notifications for everybody, so we don't like them anymore. But there's other kind of aspects to that mechanism, like background sync is being rolled out and things like that, and they're looking at other potential things that essentially could wake the service worker up from the operating system level and not necessarily need a web page open in a browser to do that.
I do a lot of line of business applications, so I haven't yet found a justification for doing larger applications and PWAs and going full in on that. But I have played around a little bit with a little bit older versions of Create React app that included service workers by default and had some issues because when we tried to roll out future releases, we would have to play around with unregistering and re-registering the service worker because we wouldn't always get the latest and greatest of the code that had been rolled out because of some of the interception that's being performed on behalf of the service worker. Are there ways around that? Or?
Yeah, well, I can't really speak a whole lot to the Create React. I helped somebody out with one about this time last year, and I just looked at the whole way that they were doing it, and I'm like, this is just such a disaster. But okay, so what you're talking about is a key aspect that I think a lot of people, especially developers, don't consider, is how to invalidate our cached content. And to me, it kind of came natural because I was actually designing applications effectively with this model well before service workers were created, but I was using local storage at the time to cache data and markup and things, and app cache, which has actually been deprecated across the board, so we don't have to worry about that monster anymore. But what you have to do is you have to determine how long should a piece of content be cached, whether it be data, whether it be markup, CSS. And so generally, one of the things that I do, I'll either create another entry in IndexedDB or something like that to correlate to that data or that response to determine how long it should live. Another way I go about doing it is I will create a rule set based on like routing patterns. Like if you think about just regular routes, like MVC routes or whatever you may do, express routes, kind of thing. It's the same kind of regular expression mentality. But with those routes, I will append a series of configuration properties. And some of those properties are invalidation rules. How long should a cached item actually stay in cache? Or how many of these items that match this pattern should be cached at a given time? I always use Amazon as an example here. I'm not going to cache everything on Amazon's site on everybody's phone. That's ridiculous. It's way too big and way too diverse and not enough space on phones to even come close to caching. But for an actual user, I mean, how many individual products are you going to go through and review the actual pages, the page details, and do searches and stuff when you're actually doing shopping? I personally don't have the numbers for what the reality is on Amazon, but let's just say it's probably somewhere between 5 and 50 products, okay? I think that's a good range to just play with. I could easily cache 50 product detail web pages and probably another 50 or 100 search or product or category page kind of results easily. And I could essentially do a first in, first out queue or a last in, last out or something along those lines. And also base it on how recently was it actually viewed or returned, all these kind of things. I can put logic in there for that. Another thing is, what am I going to do with all the photos? Because those photos are really what's going to consume the space for something like Amazon. Safari, well, on iOS in particular, limits us to 50 megs in the service worker cache. Now, it says it limits to 500 megs in IndexedDB, but I've actually put several gigabytes in my iPhone's IndexedDB. So I think they just say 500 to be safe. So one of the things that I'm playing with for some clients right now is actually offloading media storage to IndexedDB, because it doesn't have to be JSON data that goes there. It can be, you know, it can be any binary or text-based or object-based. It doesn't really matter for IndexedDB, which is really nice. If you're not familiar with IndexedDB, it's a document database in the browser. It's got a very low-level API. I don't recommend actually writing code against it. I use a very simple library called LocalForge that makes it look like local storage's API, except it's promise-based. But there's other ones like PouchDB gives you more like a Mongo database kind of interface to it and things like that. So find an abstraction library to actually play with it. But I always use that to essentially store that off. So like in this case, I've got one client who's got video files and they want to make them available offline so that somebody could be on an airplane and watch the video from the application without having to worry about bandwidth issues or consuming cellular data plans or whatever it may be. And so we're going to put them in those media files into IndexedDB just so we make sure we've got the storage space available. But the number of images for like an online e-commerce like an Amazon or something like that, that's something you have to play with to figure out what works best. So if I've got 50 product detail pages, each one of those product detail pages may have, you know, 5 or 6 product images in that top thing that you can kind of scroll through or whatever. So how many of those images am I going to actually persist and store? I need to set a limit on those. I could possibly even say the amount of size that I'm actually taking up. Some of the browsers will actually give you a storage quota API that you can actually hit to see where you're at. So you can kind of see what pressure you're under and kind of devise your own rules. The main thing you want to do is you want to make sure that you don't let the browser decide what gets thrown overboard. You want to decide what gets thrown overboard. And so as much control as you have there. Now, John, in your case, you were saying, okay, so we updated the application, but it was still hanging on to those old assets. So what I see done wrong in so many implementations of a service worker, and usually it's something like what you're talking about, Create React, or there's a couple of WordPress plugins that are really bad about this. They just effectively just cache everything, and that's that. But the web's a very fluid, dynamic experience, and it's constantly changing. I mean, just because you came and read a blog post that I wrote yesterday, I may have updated it last night because I'm constantly tweaking those little things for SEO purposes. That kind of stuff can roll in and out. So you need to devise essentially either a versioning history or that invalidation experience. And there's other ways to do it. I mean, we could go on and on about all kinds of different things I've played with. Some have worked, some I really haven't. Different things like that. Personally, I like the whole keep a time to live or max items or for a named cache kind of thing. But every application is going to be different. If you did like a Fandango type of app with movies, the movies only change like once a week. So you could literally hang on to the cache of movies for 7 straight days if you really wanted to set the actual physical time for them to invalidate. That's really what you're looking for in that scenario. If I was doing a real-time stock transaction app, I wouldn't cache any of it because it's real-time stuff. Now, what I may do is I may cache it in case they go offline and say, this is stale. This is the last known value kind of thing or something like that. But if it's time sensitive like that and it's changing really fast, there's really no need to cache the data in that case. The other thing that I do a lot in service workers, I actually render the stuff in the service worker. And I actually just published an article right before we got on the call here about that story with Patrick and how I kind of realized that the concept of what we do with single page applications is effectively obsolete because of service workers. Because all that rendering and stuff we've been doing on the UI thread, really we could either do on the server side, but we could also really do it inside the service worker. And I've got a few applications I've built where as soon as you hit the website, the site's small enough and it's easy enough to render. I just go ahead and render all the pages in the service worker and cache them so you never have to hit the network again. So if you're small enough, you could actually go that route. And, you know, even if it's dynamic data, like you're talking about line of business stuff, a lot of that stuff can still be offloaded into the service worker, reduce your network chatter, reduce your UI thread demand, and essentially make the application just more fluid. I've had lots of line of business applications where they were just so slow because the architecture that they had chosen was just not right. But having this kind of caching in the middle and offloading things, like as simple things, one example comes to, I had a client with an application that wanted to have access to all like 33,000 zip codes in the United States. It was available as a choice because it was kind of a real estate kind of based app. And they were querying the server every single time they needed to get all 33,000 records.
Oh, wow.
But how often does the zip codes in the United States change? You could cache that for, you know, a couple of weeks probably and not really worry about it. But you could also do a silent upgrade in the background on that data bit too. Without the user actually needing to trigger anything, you could just essentially kind of check the health of your application when they come, when they log in the morning, have we made any updates overnight? And we need to update some data or those kind of things, or periodic checks to see if some of that support data maybe has changed. It just depends. So there's all kinds of interesting things you can do that not only will make the client side more efficient, but it also reduces the load you need to have on the server side.
Yeah, and I can't remember if it was the next major version or the next minor version, but shortly after we encountered that problem, the Create React app actually deployed the service worker and had it configured to be off and not on by default. So it seems like maybe that was there wasn't enough guidance there. There wasn't enough information on how to be successful with that.
You know, there's not a whole lot out there about invalidation, and I think that's unfortunate. So maybe I'll get some more content out there about it.
Yeah, and you know, being a line of business application and a relatively small team and nimble and agile, we were pushing updates, deploying to production every 3 to 5 days or so. And so it was very difficult to, we hadn't put enough time into our invalidation strategy and how we would update our clients. So it was more trouble than it was worth, and it wasn't giving us the benefit that we were expecting to get. So with that, what are the benefits of PWAs and service workers? Why would a company, a project, a team, an application want to go the direction of PWAs and service workers?
That's a great question. So business stakeholders, especially when it's a consumer-facing interface, the message around progressive web apps is their better user experience. They're only better user experience if you actually design a better user experience. But I like the fact that they're actually trying to push it. Honestly, the term progressive web app, it's kind of a quasi-marketing term that Alex Russell and his wife came up with to kind of, in a way, to kind of rebrand the web to get it away from some negative connotations that are out there, the negative perceptions, because they're like, none of this stuff is really accurate about the web. So the progressive web app is really about doing the web right, right? Making things fast, but usable. Mobile first mentality, taking advantage of platform features that are there, all this kind of stuff. So that's really what it is. It's more about the way you actually deliver a user experience than anything else. Now, from a technical perspective, this is where stakeholders tend to fog up on me and just go, I have no clue what you just said to me. It's stuff like I was just talking about. How can I actually scale the application to make it more efficient? That's one way with the service worker. Another way is, what can I do to organize my code a little better? Because one of the problems that you have when you're deploying to a client versus doing server-side work, when I'm on the server, I know the environment. I control everything in that environment. But when I go to a consumer device or even a line of business device, I don't necessarily have control over anything in that environment. It could be all over the place. But one thing that I know for sure is when I've got a service worker there, I know there's a certain bottom level of quality of API and code syntax and stuff that I can actually use. I don't have to worry about dealing with polyfills, for example, when there's a service worker there. I know there's a baseline of support for different things there. So from a developer point of view, I've effectively got kind of a controlled environment again that I can put that logic in that may require all kinds of hacky things and stuff like that, just in case someone's got like an outlying browser. The good news these days for the web is that pretty much every mainstream browser is on par. The one that's kind of still falling behind is Apple Safari is probably about 2 years behind, in my opinion, on everything. The other side of it, too, is Apple just never talks to anybody about what they're doing. So they're just like ship stuff and we figure it out kind of thing. But yeah, from a business point of view, business stakeholders like it because they see the messaging around making a better experience. When you're talking about like reaching to customers or consumer-oriented thing like an SEO kind of space, Google and the other search engines have messaging out there basically saying there's improvements to be had. And if you look at a lot of the case studies around progressive web apps, companies that have adopted progressive web application strategies, pretty much across the board have reported improved KPIs. And KPIs basically mean we make more money with less effort. That's the best way to put it. And they're all over the place. It could be they're looking at we've got more page views for Sebastian, more repeat sessions from the same customers, higher order totals, more orders from the same customer, all these kind of things, just because they're more accessible. Another thing, if you're targeting anything to do with kind of a developing world, I talk a lot to people in India, for example. Progressive web apps with companies are really big in India because the phones there are usually low-end phones. native applications are usually 100, 250 megabytes in size and take up a lot of space on those drives. Whereas a progressive web app for the same app is, you know, more like 250K or 500K at the most kind of thing. There's marketing considerations, not having to deal with the app store. If you got to go through the app store to deliver an app for the mobile thing, all kinds of companies are reporting issues, like with, especially with Apple. Because Apple's purging apps from the app store in mass, and they're also rejecting in mass.
All of the things that you were just saying seemed like quite a few nails in a coffin to me. And I personally have been joking with our mobile team that we're just going to write PWAs and replace all of them.
I agree.
But is there a reason why you would not want to do a PWA and instead go native?
I get asked this a lot. I don't have a good answer because, you know, unless you absolutely need some platform specific feature, which very rarely does anybody actually need something that's just limited to that platform. I mean, there's a few hardware things that people are debating about that they've wanted on the web for a while. And I'm not quite sure why, like access to somebody's contact list. I'm like, that's kind of, I don't know how many applications really want to have access to that. The web share API gives me access to that from a user point of view. I don't necessarily need to suck them into my application. You know, it's things like that I'm looking at, like geofencing something that people are talking about. Even in native app land, I don't know how many applications use geofencing. I don't know that it's that big of a deal. Eventually it may be, but all I see is just marketing abuse with that API.
So sort of taking this in another direction, you definitely have lots of experience, and we, one of the things we ask all of our guests is to sort of speak directly to the people, those listeners that we have that are just getting started or trying to level up in their career. So do you have any like words of wisdom or piece of advice that you would kind of give them directly?
The number one thing I tell people to do, because I get asked this a lot by especially junior developers, is just create applications. You don't have to get paid for them. Just find something. And sometimes I was telling somebody this weekend, I was like, one of the things that I do sometimes just to practice things, I go on GitHub and I find a repo of something. And I tend to find like little games like 2048 or Solitaire or something like that. And I'm like, how can you fork that project and then turn it into something better to practice the skill that you're wanting? If nothing else, that'll keep it interesting for you, but it'll also challenge you to see how to actually implement something, but also the challenges of actually what is implementing that technology or that feature set. So I always want to, I mean, like I said, I get up every morning and watch YouTube videos and stuff like that every day, probably half hour worth of videos just to learn stuff. You've got to constantly be learning things and don't necessarily limit yourself just to software development. One thing I think that helps me differentiate myself from a lot of developers is I try to learn how does business actually run? Why are certain things kind of important to the process of a business being successful? If the work I'm doing doesn't make the company better, is it really worth my time to do? I want to kind of understand how it fits into that overall puzzle. That's something to me. So I do spend a lot of time trying to understand online marketing or just marketing in general and business concepts and stuff, because I want to be able to talk to those people who are actually paying me and explain why is this going to make your life easier and more profitable is ultimately what they really care about. So you got to kind of understand that, but you want to make sure you're as efficient as possible with things. So you know, like I said, I try to fork applications a few times a year and just play with them. I don't necessarily jump on all the latest new things that come out. I don't go hit shiny balls constantly. I guess I'm at the point in my career where I'm like, oh yeah, that's just another thing. I got to stay focused. So I think that's another problem we have in our little space is like every week or so, there's some new shiny ball that comes out. And we all like, oh, we have to go do that right now. And a lot of times it can be a distraction. I've seen lots of code bases go way off the rails by trying to implement all kinds of new things that come out during the project. But yeah, constantly learning, constantly be doing to learn too. That's how I learn the best, is just by doing.
Okay. Well, if someone wanted to be maybe getting into some progressive web apps, like we've been talking about, is there any resources that you might point people towards?
I probably have more than I think I do. I mean, I've got tons of articles on my site, that's for sure. Google's got quite a few tutorials out there on different aspects of, you know, service workers. You know, things like the, you know, accessing the camera or geolocation, all those kind of things. There's all kinds of aspects to this whole thing. User experience and stuff like that. From my point of view, I've got the PWA starter, which is just pwastarter.lovetodev.com. And that's just a wizard to walk you through. That's, you know, that's one of those things, like if I go out and fork the 2048 repo on GitHub, I can copy that locally, post it somewhere, and run it through the wizard and get my bits and stuff to plug in to make it a simple, basic progressive web app at that point. So that's one little thing you could do. I've got a book out on progressive web apps. I've got an online course for progressive web apps. If you just go to pwacourse.com, that'll direct you to it. There's several, like I said, there's several online courses. There's a few books that are out. Another good author that gets kind of into the weeds a little bit, sometimes a little bit more than I do, is Max Fertman down in Argentina. He goes by Fert, F-I-R-T. He's got some really good Medium articles on iOS and progressive web apps, and really just kind of go in and break it down. He's like, okay, this works, this doesn't work. But I think he literally stays up for like 2 or 3 days every time a new beta comes out on iOS and sits there and just bangs on it quite a bit and writes it up. He does a fantastic job with those articles.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. How about if people wanted to follow you? Is there a social media, Twitter? Where should they follow you?
That's a good question. I'm kind of trying to pivot right now from Twitter to LinkedIn, but I've been on Twitter since Twitter came out, like day 7. But it's just Chris Love on Twitter. You should just be able to look me up by Chris Love and kind of parse me through the different Chris Loves that may come up there. I'm going to be the one that's got web stuff. So, I've got a Facebook page for Love to Dev. I don't really do Instagram for development. That doesn't really mesh very well with development. Primarily, it's going to be Twitter and now I'm trying to build up the LinkedIn stuff. I've got a Love to Dev page on LinkedIn, but I just haven't really built it up yet. So.
Cool. And then you mentioned that you weren't probably doing too many more speaking engagements, but you said you had one coming up. What is that?
So the next one I've got on the calendar right now would be, I think it's March 13th through 15th in Delhi, India. We're going to try to work that out so I can also go to Hyderabad as well while I'm there.
Nice.
Do that. But we may add some more dates early in the year. We're talking about doing like a little road trip type thing between different cities, and like New York and here in Philly and DC might be on the list. Maybe Chicago. We don't know yet. So they'll most likely be to like a local Microsoft office because they're really good at letting us do like developer kind of events and stuff. So we'll see how that goes though.
All right. Thanks, Chris. This was a lot of fun. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That was Chris Love. Chris is a progressive web app and search engine optimization expert. He's a 12-time Microsoft MVP who started writing HTML in 1992.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at SixFigureDev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.